The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. MyBills.ie. Help save time with bill payment online for free. Unpost. Do more. The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. Sterling and dollars are commission free at selected post offices. Unpost. Do more.
Hello there, and a very good morning to you. You're very welcome indeed to the programme this morning, and we will start. I suppose we should start today with the Sunday World, because the Sunday World got the story that more or less every other paper has been following, and that has resulted in the TD Nulty quitting his seat after such a very, very short period of time. That's Patrick Nulty. And presumably with that, there are going to be all sorts of political consequences. The Mirror has as well. TD quits over sex email. Well, no, actually, the Irish Sun didn't lead with that. They're talking about Lavelle. And then the Daily Star similarly. Now we come to the Sunday Times. And very nice photograph of Brian O'Driscoll and Amy Huberman when he was getting the Freedom of Dublin yesterday. Their main story, TD Nulty quits Dáil after lewd web exchanges. Binchy leaves 10 million in her will. Actually, it's about Maeve Binchy, and she's quoted somewhere as saying that more or less every year since she was 21, she wrote another will, because she loved changing her will and giving gifts to friends and imagining what would appeal to this friend or that friend or the other friend. Anyway, Boston College tapes led to charge over McConville's disappearance, and Russians storm into the airbase and then threaten a photographer. Now, the Sunday Business Post. Revenue goes after the property tax dodgers. Apparently, there's a further surge in declaration of undervaluation is expected before the March the 31st deadline. And no doubt we'll be talking a little bit about that later on. And they also have cabinet showdown looms on penalty points. A lot about penalty points and whistleblowing in the papers today. The Sunday Indo. Now it's coming for a head time. Coalition in crisis. Labour ups the ante as support for Varadkar grows. Shatter and Callanan on the rack. And they also have TD quits over schoolgirl 17 and the text scandal. And Pulse, a gossip mag for Gardaí. That's a piece written by Brendan O'Connor. Now let me introduce my guest to you this morning. Robert Hoban, Director of Auctions at Allsop Space. Niamh Harrigan, Senior Lecturer in Sociology at UCC. Brendan Keenan, Economics Columnist, Irish Indo. Jackie Lavin, Businesswoman. And Evan Cullen, President of the Irish Pilots Association. And you're all very welcome indeed to the programme this morning. And before I go to you guys, I'm going to go to Fionnán Sheehan, who's Group Political Editor with the Irish Independent. Fionnán, good morning to you.
Good morning, Marion.
You'll have to put on the headphones there, folks, if you want to hear Fionnán. This was a seat that was filled following the death of Brian Lenehan.
That's correct. In the 2011 general election, obviously, Brian Lenehan held his seat in Dublin West, which he himself had held since 1996, since the passing of his father. When he won that by-election in Dublin West, Brian Lenehan very sadly passed away in June of 2011, and the by-election to fill his seat then was held in October 2011, the same day as the presidential election, and you'll recall the referenda that were held that day as well. Patrick Nulty, who had run for the Labour Party as Joan Burton's running mate in the 2011 general election, won that seat. Effectively, kind of made modern history. First time in almost 30 years since a government party TD had won a by-election, but going back to Noel Tracy in Galway for Fianna Fáil back in 1982.
When do you figure will be the next local? Will they run it with the local elections, or will they run a separate by-election?
Yeah, the safe bet would be to suggest that they will run it in October. Effectively, what will kick in this week once Patrick Nulty's resignation officially goes through is a 6-month tick-down clock whereby the by-election has to be held within 6 months. So that basically brings you up to the October bank holiday weekend. So you'd have to have it held by the end of October. So the safe bet would be that it would be held in October with other by-elections. We're most likely going to have a by-election also in Dublin South West because Brian Hayes is expected to get elected to the European Parliament. We could have others such as if Luke Mingflanagan gets elected, you've got Roscommon South Leitrim, Simon Harris, potentially in Wicklow, whoever the European Commissioner may be. So you could have a raft of by-elections on that particular day. The less safe bet, but potentially a more attractive political option is for the government, is to run it on the same day as the local and European elections on May 23rd. And the rationale behind that would be that the Fine Gael candidate is most likely going to be Senator Eamon Coughlin. He would have it would give him a bit of a strategic advantage in that the other candidates running in the field would have one eye on the local elections, one eye on the by-election, and he'd be the only one solely focused on that. And he could say, well, look, I'm the only one who's actually in national potics already. So there's a potential calculation there.
Fianna Fáil?
Fianna Fáil, most likely David McGuinness, who was their candidate last time out in the Brian Lenehan by-election, did very well, got almost 22% of the vote. Very respectable vote, considering Fianna Fáil's calamities at that particular point in time. Big psychological boost for the party. If it's held, obviously, in the next couple of months, definitely him. After the local elections, it'll depend who performs in the local elections, who does well.
Just for a moment, they never considered running Connor as the younger brother of Brian.
Yeah, well, Connor has moved on to bigger and better things at this stage. There'll obviously be two options for Connor now later on this year if he wanted to come back into national politics, and that'd be this Dublin West by-election and also the one in his old constituency of Dublin South West. But Connor hasn't really shown an appetite for that. He's currently working as a consultant out in Russia. So, you know, if he decided to come back, there are opportunities there, but he hasn't shown any appetite for that. Also, in the last couple of years, you've actually had Brian Lenehan's son, Tom, entering into student politics, becoming president of Trinity College Dublin Students Union, also being linked with positions in Union Students in Ireland. So clearly, politics is in the blood there, so one never knows there. After the local elections, from Fianna Fáil's perspective, maybe Jack Chambers in Castleknock, who's been tipped as the next Leo Varadkar, maybe he does well in the local elections. The party has a rethink there. Maybe Mary Fitzpatrick doesn't get elected in the European elections and they decide to move her just slightly down the road from her current constituency of Dublin Central into Dublin West. So there are options there, but most likely David McGuinness.
And Labour?
Labour, again, depends on the local elections, but as of now, you'll be looking at Mary McCamley, who is the councillor who took Patrick Nulty's seat on Fingal County Council when he became a TD. He had got elected in 2009. Under the dual mandate, he had to give up his seat when he became a TD. She took the seat. She stayed with the party even when Patrick Nulty first resigned from the parliamentary party just 5 weeks after the by-election in the wake of the budget 2012.
Right.
And subsequently, he resigned from the party. So she's the option there, but again, depends upon the local elections. Sinn Féin probably looking for a better performance than they had last time out in the by-election, only 9%. Obviously, they've gone way up in the polls ever since. Paul Donnelly was the candidate then. Again, you'd chalk him down for now, but depends upon what the local elections throw up. Another strong contender on the left would be Ruud Coppinger of the Socialist Party, closely associated with Joe Higgins. But psychologically, you know, by-elections tend to be funny. People kind of look at it and go, well, they already have a seat there, so do we want another one? So very much wide open. At the moment, you'd look at it and say, Eamon Coughlin, David McGuinness, Ruud Coppinger, Paul Donnelly. Right. That's the kind of runner
okay.
you're looking at.
Well, obviously, interesting times ahead. I mean, I think people were very shocked when they read their headlines this morning, but I saw that you were nodding there, Evan, when I said something about Conor Lennon.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if he did make a run. I know a few people associated with him, and I know he's never been off the emails and looking at what's going on in Irish politics, despite his current position. Somebody did suggest to me, actually, he might be an advisor to Putin on this Crimea thing.
Well, I wondered. It crossed my mind.
It crossed my mind as well. And so that's why I probably nodded and laughed.
Brendan?
Well, I mean, it's pure politics. By-elections, I leave it to Finan, but they're not the same as general elections. You need pretty precise knowledge as to what will happen. I think I hadn't really thought of it before that, of course, there are going to be several coming up. And the idea, if it works out that way, that there'd be a lot of by-elections on one day in October, that would be a kind of an unusual thing, if not unprecedented.
Right. Well, it's an interesting time politically anyway, what with whistleblowers and ministers speaking out of line and stepping out of line and lines, as they say in the sand. Jackie, were you following any of those stories?
Oh, indeed I was. You couldn't miss it for the last 2 weeks. And it absolutely astonishes me how people, when they're so obviously wrong, they're still trying to pretend they're right. How can a wrong be a right? Now, everybody has come out. I mean, the dogs in the street are talking about this man, Callanan, should just simply put his hands up, be a big boy and say, do you know something? I got it wrong. I rushed to judgment. I didn't, consider my words properly. And I was wrong. And just apologise and move on. Instead, now we have the Taoiseach sort of trying to, give us some red herrings that nobody, quite frankly, is following, saying that, oh, OK, this is being used as a political football internally, which obviously, of course, it is. But it still doesn't, he's not actually, talking about the issue of the whistleblower. He's still saying, he's pulling back and saying, oh, well, these are the boys arguing, handbags, at the cabinet table.
Right.
Which is a total red herring. It's not in one sense, but in the other sense, deal with one thing first and then move on to the handbags at the cabinet table. Oh. And with Varadkar obviously making a play, which he has done.
Okay, Niamh.
But I think the Taoiseach's response to Varadkar's comments is really interesting, given the fact that we have a looming by-election now, because essentially what he said to Varadkar was, ministers should keep their views to themselves. But we already have this highly centralised political system. I mean, those local elections that are happening in May, the amount of powers that local councillors have are extremely limited. The amount of powers that people elected to the European Parliament are extremely limited. We have this incredibly centralised system whereby the only people with power are those in cabinet. If they can't talk, well then, we're moving more towards a system where there's very little freedom of expression. And, in fairness, when the government did come in, there were a lot of promises around political reform, around creating a system where there was room for dissent and other voices. And I think when there's dissent on this issue and there's a lot of popular support for, I think, the dissenter in this case, I think that has something that has to be taken on board.
Brendan Keenan, now it's coming for a head time.
Yeah, well, just going back slightly, the one thing that I meant to mention on page 6 of the Sunday Independent, John Brennan has a Fianna Fáil report which shows that they're really making no progress in Dublin at all. And I was really struck, they in the whole of Dublin, they managed to raise €20 in a fundraising this year. But that was better than last year when they raised nothing at all. And so that may be relevant to the by-election. But I think, I agree with Niamh, the politics of this. I mean, I think the way most people would see it is that the Labour ministers leapt out of their bunkers when Leo Varadkar went over the trenches. And that's very odd because the public is clearly, and certainly the media, exercised about this. And it has taken the Transport Minister. Now, curiously...
But the Transport Minister is part of this brief.
Precisely. And according to the newspapers, both Pat Leahy, particularly in the Sunday Business Post, it says that Leo Varadkar has been trying for a year to talk about this to Alan Shatter. Now, the Department of Justice, in the usual way, says no formal request has been received. But that's a formal request. And Gene Kerrigan in the back of the Sunday Independent is saying the Taoiseach says there's a process for dealing with this. No, says Gene, the trouble is there's no process for dealing with any of this.
So I
certainly agree with Niamh that the senior ministers in this government seem very out of touch with public opinion, particularly the senior ministers in the Labour Party, which is the party that ought to benefit from reform. They can't benefit much from the economics that we currently have. But, they have led from behind on this one. Yeah. The three reporters in the front of the Sunday Independent, they say that if this isn't resolved at Tuesday's cabinet, that Mr. Callanan's position will become untenable and
it's
perhaps the
Aaron
Shatters. I have no view on that myself, but that's what they're saying.
It's extraordinary how people let things roll on and on when actually...
It could have been dealt with in 24 hours by just simply coming out and saying, I was wrong and I made a mistake. That's it.
But there's also Evan, you wanted to go to Evan. And this,
well, I think there is a list of grievances, you might say, listed by Shane Whelan, page 2 of the Sunday Independent, that he says the Minister for Transport has with Shatter and the guards and also the court service, a whole list of things that haven't been done, that he's wanted done. But I think in this instance, you know, Leo Varadkar has been absolutely correct. And it just doesn't go to the disgusting comments, as bad and all as they were for a number of people. I think there was, in one of the papers today, the editorial of the Sunday Times, there's actually a quote around the, you know, the commissioner when he said, there's not been a whisper from any other of the 13,000, you know, and to me, that was a message to the 13,000, you know, I put these two guys up here on a crucifix and this is what happens.
However, it has to be said in the on the commissioner's side, and the data protection people were investigating the privacy of matters that were going to the Gardaí in terms of ordinary citizens. And the data commissioner was certainly on the side of the Garda commissioner on not sending that portfolio to the PAC. Now, the PAC would assert that they had a right to have it, but that there was private information about named people on that. So, like, maybe it's not all black and white. Robert, do you have a view?
Yeah, I think certainly from our own experience, I mean, the data protection is a huge area of concern for every citizen in the country. I know that Billy Hawkes has come out a couple of times there and giving his view on it. And I see where he's coming from, because you have vast amounts of data. Ireland's a small country. Word of mouth travels very fast.
Sure does.
And if due processes aren't adhered to, then it becomes a dangerous scenario to be in. So I suppose there's a balance required there. Yeah, certainly.
True as that may be, one thing that has been forgotten largely is the Garda's own investigation into this, I think by an assistant commissioner, which found that a couple of guards had made a couple of mistakes in penalty points. The inspectorate, with very limited remit, in a very short time, discovers widespread gross abuse. So if the guards cannot find, with all their resources in their force, something that is patently obvious as soon as you start looking, then you do have to say that things about privacy have to come second. If we had any faith in the Garda being able to deal with these matters, then we could do with this. But they had their chance to deal with it. They set up their own report. But they couldn't find anything.
I think this relates to some of the critical comments in the papers today about Billy Hawkes' intervention in this, because essentially, you know, if you look at the way the process went in terms of the O'Mahony report, you can only, from the whistleblower's position, you know, Hawkes is kind of saying, well, they did their thing, it was investigated, they should have left it alone subsequently. But that line of argument only operates if the response is deemed adequate. And subsequently, what we know from the inspector report is that the response really wasn't adequate. So therefore, I have to say, I think the Data Protection Commissioner is not at one with the public opinion here, in that he's lining up behind a view which presumes an effective response which actually wasn't there. And
I would take your point, but I mean, you can't have data commissioners changing their rules based on public opinion.
No, but I think there's a concern and there's a tension at the moment, Marion, between the PAC, the Public Accounts Committee, and how it works, and data protection as an issue, and also, you know, the kind of legal interventions to protect. And I suppose the problem here is that the level of expertise required to make a call on data protection issues is so high that it's very difficult for somebody coming from the other side of the fence to actually unpick a data protection argument. And I think that's one of the key problems.
Well, Marion, there was a comment from the commissioner in a press release where he said that there's been no bugging of GSOC, either authorised or unauthorised. I didn't hear the data commissioner jump up and down. What did that mean? You know, I've yet to hear an explanation as to What does that mean?
Well, that's on the way, we hope.
But it's back to the core problem. Not alone was the issue not dealt with, but also the way that the messengers, be it the whistleblowers, were dealt with. And they were dealt with in the most appalling manner. I mean, one of them had a rat tied to his door, you know. So they were actually pilloried and are still trying. They're still trying. Now the public opinion, obviously, from right-minded people has swung in their favour, obviously. But, I mean, it's back to the core issue. The complaints were not dealt with, but certainly the whistleblowers were dealt with in the most appalling manner.
I would have thought the whole point about whistleblowing is that you're breaking rules and probably the law when you blow the whistle. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any need to be a whistleblower. You could go through processes.
But it's not against the law
there's protection.
The guard, yes.
Yeah, but the law essentially says you're allowed to break the law, if you're a whistleblower. So I think the data commissioner didn't take that into account. A whistleblower is somebody who feels that sticking within the rules or even the law is not going to work, and this matter is of such importance they have to go outside, and that includes going outside. The trouble with the data protection is the only thing where you actually have, everybody has them, something to do with the modern communications, you have an office purely dedicated to dealing with these matters. So that's all they see. That's only their remit. So we have to bear that in mind. Technically, I'm sure the commissioner is right. But the whole point about whistleblowing is that you're doing things you shouldn't do because you feel you have to do them. And then we're supposed to have legislation that will protect you from the consequences.
Mm. Caller says the data commissioner clearly thought that the actions of the whistleblowers in releasing information was inappropriate. Yet the media have completely ignored that. It's called there for Leo Varadkar to be the Fine Gael leader, but I presume that will come later.
That was his mother.
Pardon?
His mother.
We have been promised legislation, though, on whistleblowers under the Protected Disclosures Act 2013. I think it was one of the planks of the Labour coming into government. It still hasn't happened. I believe it's gone through the Shannon. It's probably, I think it's at the second stage in the Dáil. But it provides for, you know, where there can be an intervention from the circuit court if somebody is getting sacked or victimised as a result of whistleblowing, and also for 5 times your salary in compensation. The difficulty with it, I see it, is if you're the Garda Commissioner and you're disgusted at behaviour of two of your guards, like 5 times their salary is a very, very low price to pay for their silence or the silence of the other 13,000 officers. That's just one failing I would see. And obviously we need to see the code of practice that comes from that legislation. But it's absolutely essential this legislation now comes in. Because I know
it's
in my own sector,
extraordinary in some ways that we're having this debate. You know, if you look at the 3 major reports that were done after the bailout and the cry, particularly Peter Nyberg's report, I mean, all of them, but particularly Nyberg, absolutely highlighted the central nature of having this type of legislation. And really, not only is it surprising that the legislation still hasn't been passed and it's not there, but that we have, you know, a political elite who is lining up really against the whistleblowers and has done. And there's divisions in that elite at the moment, and that's good to see. But it's worrying kind of 3-4 years down the line from that process that we were all supposed to learn so much from, and this was supposed to be a new era.
But it's ironic as well that you're looking at legislation to be brought in, and that minister is Alan Shatter, and he's embroiled in this whole controversy. And from the soundings that he's been making, he's anti-whistleblowing. That's the message that's coming across.
You could say that the message is anti-whistleblowing from the cabinet. You know, I have to say a lot of people found it rather refreshing when Leo Varadkar said, yeah, he had confidence in the commissioner, but he wasn't beyond criticism.
Well, I thought it was very similar to Gay Byrne's comments yesterday on your own show. I thought he elucidated very well, where he was saying that with his own dealings that he was full of praise for the Garda Síochána, but he was almost saying that they were sort of hoisted by their own petard because they were so secretive about their dealings and their knowledge. And when it comes to not sharing it, that it sends the message across that actually they're trying to protect something. When in actual fact, it's probably just a culture.
Right. OK, listen, we'll move on to that story that is as the lead story, really, right now for the last fortnight. And there's a lot of coverage on it still today. One in particular, which I thought was interesting, was Michael Sheridan's article in the Sunday Times about the police seizing records. You had a look at that, Evan, I do believe.
Yeah, I, this is standard practice for all the records of the airline to be to be got at and investigated. In particular, what seems to be catching some attention now is the use of and the carriage of lithium-ion batteries. And
what are the, if you were a, first of all, if when you're a pilot on a plane, do you know what's in the hold?
There is the cargo manifest, but in addition to the cargo manifest, there is a notification to the captain that he must sign off on of hazardous material on board. And the debate has gone on. There are some, let's say, vested interests who have tried to make sure that lithium-ion batteries are not on the hazardous notified cargo. And there are other people then who are saying that they should never be carried on passenger aircraft.
Why?
Well, because they have, and regrettably, there's been 140 incidents in aviation of a lithium-ion battery failing. And when it fails, what happens is it overheats and then it goes on fire. It is a very unusual device in that it doesn't need oxygen from the ambient air to sustain combustion. It actually generates its own oxygen. Many junior search students, in fact, would know that lithium is in a group of elements.
You can't put it out?
You can't put it out with carbon dioxide, which a lot of the suppression system, fire suppression systems in aircraft, what they do is they flood the hold with carbon dioxide to displace the oxygen and therefore eliminate the combustion
and
reaction.
And have there been incidences of that?
But there's actually been an aircraft lost, a cargo aircraft lost with lithium ion batteries. But
really?
Yeah, the difficulty too for, and I can understand to some degree Malaysians' problems, that Malaysia and Taiwan are leading producers of lithium ion batteries. So therefore, it's part of their export trade, and it's been somewhat reluctant in coming forward that there was lithium-ion batteries in the aircraft.
Took a long time.
It took a long time for this to come forward. And the problem is, you know, lithium-ion batteries are the future when they're properly managed, because Boeing have started to use them now in their latest generation of aircraft as part of the electrical system.
Well, I'm not altogether very reassuring.
But people would know that the 787 was grounded, I think, for approximately 20 weeks there, because there was the management of the batteries had become an issue. But now they're getting through it. But battery technologies with this lithium ion are the leading edge. They are substantially more efficient given than the nickel cadmium batteries. So they are the future. In fact, I can tell you, Marion, NASA, I understand, actually did a business case for mining lithium on the moon, because rock on the moon has got a very high degree.
You're not pulling my leg.
I'm not pulling your
leg, are you?
No, but I suppose when you're in space exploration, you're always looking for a commercial reason to go back into space and to go back to the moon.
The really curious thing about this case is that the plane flew for 5 hours. If it had crashed, you'd sort of say, oh, right, the batteries. But in what circumstances could you fly for 5 or 6 hours with a fire on board, if any? And then, you know, if that's not the case, then it must have been some strange human behaviour in the cockpit, or sort of a, you know.
I
was terrible talking about this thing, but I was reminded of, do you remember the terrible Moorgate crash? I mean, it's only happened once in a lifetime. A tube driver in London drove his tube train straight into the wall of Moorgate Station at the end of the line, deliberately to kill himself, and many of his passengers, of course, died with him. Now, that's only happened once in the 100 years of the tube, but everything can happen once. So we're left with the possibility of something like that by one of the pilots.
Could
you imagine a fire where the plane flew on?
I can't imagine, but there's a possibility that the fire did go out and therefore the plane flew on after doing the damage. But there was, regrettably, the Egypt Air crash a number of years ago, where a pilot locked himself into the cockpit, and it's widely believed he committed suicide and brought everybody with him. On the other, the fire in the cockpit, the only 15 years ago, the Swiss Air, the in-flight entertainment system for the first class passengers, went on fire, and they couldn't control it in the cockpit. But you're talking about what happened in the fire in the cockpit is, very shortly after communications are lost, the airplane is lost. And that didn't happen in this case.
I was reading on a blog called Wire, I think it was. Yeah. And the guy who wrote it is a very experienced pilot. Yeah. And he raised a possibility that, you know, if you're looking for conspiracy theories, maybe there's no conspiracy theory here at all. And that the pilot changed direction because something like that had gone wrong, yeah. heading, as he hoped, for the nearest runway, and was overcome by something. And
well, Evan, isn't there a theory doing the rounds at the moment about a fire in the E&E bay?
Yeah.
Which...
What's E&E?
The electronic and electronics.
It's located immediately under the cockpit, particularly in a wide body aircraft.
Which would knock out the transponder straight away
yeah.
and potentially overcome the pilots. But surely they would have had time to put their masks on, I would have thought. Or...
Yeah, but the difficulty, again, with all these theories, we're trying to make the theories fit only the known facts, yeah. and we don't have all the facts. So this is really the speculation. Like, they're looking at suicide. I really would not like to think that that's... You know, the captain here was 18 years, and just because he had a row with his wife doesn't mean he wanted to commit suicide. Otherwise, there'd be airplanes falling out of the sky everywhere. So,
are there that many rows? There are.
Well, I'm sure pilots are the same as everybody else in life, Marion. You know.
But if it flew on for 5 hours afterwards, well, how come it wasn't picked up on radar from? I mean, surely if a plane disappears out of the sky and disappears off the radar and they sign off from one station, they say, OK, no, we're now heading west.
For
towards such
or whatever.
Well, there's two fundamental types of radar. There's the primary radar, which does not require the aircraft to be giving off a signal. In other words, you send up beams, they bounce off the fuselage and they come back and then you read where the aircraft is. The secondary radar, then, what it uses is it sends data to either via satellite or to a ground station about where it is and what it is doing, right? The primary radar in civilian life is not that great. It's about 60 nautical miles, perhaps 100 at a push. In military terms, we know the military are over 200 nautical miles. I would imagine they're a lot more, but they tell us they're at 200 nautical miles. There are various means by which the military would have been able to track this aircraft. For example, one of the ways that the military always check for a missile launch anywhere on the planet, because they can come from submarines as well as ground based, is the heat plume on an infrared. Mm-hmm. They have infrared mounts on the satellites. That's how they detect a missile launch. The resolution on the infrared can be brought down to read the exhaust gases of an aircraft, particularly a jet aircraft. They can do the common track on what they know and then follow the heat plume where it goes. I was exposed to some of the technology on a visit to the States a number of years ago, and it was quite revealing. Like, they asked me for a flight number and they could tell me exactly where the aircraft was. They could tell me who the pilots were, and I think they even had the phone numbers of the pilots.
It provides some basis for the relatives being so distressed now, yeah. in this sense that all questions are not being answered.
You got the feeling that what you're talking about is true, and that it was military reasons that the information was not given out, because people don't want other people to know their own defences.
But there's enormous tension. There are a number of islands between China and Japan which are in dispute. There's also tension in Taiwan. The US have made decisions. What we do know is that there's considerable military assets in the area that just so happened to be there, and they would have been watching all of this. So I think it's widely held within the industry. They know approximately where the aircraft is. It's just a matter of getting the information out of the relevant people.
Yeah, the military mind, there's a story from the last war that the British discovered that if you cut aluminium foil to the right shape size, little bits of aluminium, and scattered them around, you could block the enemy's radar. But they never used it because the enemy would immediately see what you were doing and he would then do the same and block your radar. And after the war was over, they discovered the Germans had made the same discovery and come to the same decision. Hmm. So before the end of the war, they didn't know the other one knew about it, but they couldn't use it. And that is what has happened here. In order to protect military secrecy, they've let it out bit by bit by bit.
And
they probably knew all along.
This is what you suspect.
Yeah,
how hard is that on families and connections? I mean,
it seems to be a strategy that's backfired as well, though, because I thought the images of the distressed relatives in front of the global media, in fairness, if you were going to have a huge moment of distress, it was the place to do it, and it was the place which put the maximum amount of pressure. And it was interesting to see how there was kind of a slight change in the Malaysian authorities' response after that particular incident. And they're learning that's the only way to effect any response.
Their first their first decision was probably say nothing.
We're yeah, not whatever you say, you know, say nothing. And somebody was
but
writing
this business
about
of all the planes and all the ships out then looking for the debris and supposedly down off southwest Australia is a complete scam.
I know, so that's where it is.
No, that's well, where it is.
Yeah, because by the way, I just see here on the screen that a French satellite. Has spotted potential objects floating in the sea in the southern search corridor of the Indian Ocean. So it would look like
that. It doesn't answer why, only where.
But even the resolution, the satellite images that are coming back, I know that the resolution that's achieved on those satellites is far more than what's been indicated. In other words, they are degrading the resolution. For public consumption.
I figure.
Well, if we look at the resolution on Google Maps, surely they have Google.
Well, God, it seems outrageous in human terms.
They're putting the people through that.
If we've got Google Maps, you know, what does the US Navy have now?
Yeah. And indeed, the French satellite that is spotted, because they're no slouches on that either.
But none of that will answer why. I mean, it's still a real mystery.
Right, yeah.
Why, how this happened.
Well, we will wait and see, I suppose. I'm going to go to a break now. With us in studio today are Evan Cullen, Jackie Lavin, Brendan Keenan, Niamh Harrigan and Robert Hoban. Back after this.
1850 715 150.
The Marion Finucan Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. Sterling and dollars are commission free at selected post offices. Unpost, do more.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, there are a number of articles on a whole wide range of issues to do with property. Today, there's a lot of coverage for John Moran, who's Secretary General of the Department of Finance, and his comments, which he said are misquoted, by the way, during the week on renting versus buying. There's stuff about debt write-downs. There's the squeezed middle. They're on and on and on and on and on. And indeed, a story about something that was sold in something like 60 seconds. You were looking at that, Niamh, were you?
I think it was Robert.
Was it you? Sorry, Robert.
Yeah, you're right. I've gone through them all. Huge amounts of articles today. And I've had to sort of package them all up. It seems to be two running themes. One is the whole issue of debt write-downs and what's going on in the relationship between banks and borrowers in Ireland at the moment and potentially where that's leading. And then also, there's a new debate seems to be jumping off the pages now about renting and owning property.
Mm.
It's an age-old debate, but it's come back up again, and there's various comparisons made to the likes of the German situation and the continental situation. And
the funny thing about the German situation, and we're told that the Germans all live in apartments that they rent and they all love them, but I read elsewhere that the Germans actually don't necessarily take that point of view. That's the way it has been, but that now that their economy is improving, they would actually also like to own their own homes too. I know that you've spoken about this before, and to clarify Allsop's position on distressed properties. A message went out about what you were doing, and I know that you've been trying to bring it back.
Yeah, no, it's very clear. We're an auction house that sells property for anybody who's selling property. We don't sell repossessed. From what I'm aware, I'm the only firm in Ireland that doesn't handle repossessed family homes. And also, we've happily entered into an agreement recently not to sell properties that are being disputed through the legal channels and through the legal processes, because I think it's only fair that due process go through the courts until finality is achieved.
Because you had people standing up at your auctions and saying, you know, that's my daddy's home or my mammy's home or whatever it was. Is it because of the name? Because I think people think you're an English organisation. Nothing wrong with that, by the way. But it seems to me that you're an Irish group.
Yeah, we're an Irish company that set up in 2011. We recognised that in the market there was no transparency. It was very opaque. There were also no transactions going on in Ireland. People didn't know where the market was at. You know, we had seen prices fall anywhere from, you know, 40% to 60%, and
more.
Yeah, and the landscape in 2010, 2011 was a terrible landscape where people wanted to sell, people wanted to buy, but they didn't know where it was. So we thought it would be the fairest way is to open up an auction scenario whereby properties are publicly available, the information is made available beforehand, the legal title, contracts, things like that, and then people come and they bid at a level that they felt the market was at. And it actually proved hugely popular with buyers and bidders because they had confidence in the process. There was trust that they could see that this was that there were other bidders there. And the market found a level. And then as that's been progressing over the last 3 years, the profile has been starting to change. There's more and more financed people are coming to the auction rooms, which means that the prices are actually rising. The reserve prices and sale prices are rising. And we started off in 2011. There were a lot of overseas bidders and a lot of overseas buyers that were getting involved. But it's nice to see that that has actually changed a lot now. It's down to only 6% of buyers are from abroad. Which shows that the strength of the Irish buyer is returning. I think that's actually, it's redolent of, across the whole market. Mm-hmm. So the auction, it's a very simple process. It's there for anybody. It's open for business for anybody who wants to sell a property. Mm-hmm. There's no stipulation. But we have, in response to concerns raised, and we're totally valid concerns, when it comes to disputes between property, we don't want to be involved in that. I think that's only fair and right.
Okay.
Well, could I just say something about that, Ryan? I mean, the public, the people who weren't affected, obviously were delighted with the auctions because they were getting it. I mean, they were literally fire sales. And like it or not, but you are associated with fire sale of properties. And I think it's only recently that you've come and taken the very good decision, in my opinion, of not selling properties where there is a dispute. But you see, we're back to, and I'm not shooting you because you're the messenger, you're just part of a process, you're the end of a process. It's the whole grabbing of the properties in the first place and then writing them down and selling them off for pittance. I know that there were, there were houses sold like for, 30 and 50 grand just because that's all the money there was on the day, so there was no chance for the people to actually take, or for the lenders to take the long, or rather they decided not to take the long term view of keeping the person in the house and working out some kind of solution, which seems to be the case now. Again, in the paper today, it looks like AIB and other banks are taking, the much more pragmatic view of, writing down some of the debt, maybe giving longer, longer time to pay it back, all this kind of thing. So then everybody wins. Nobody wins in a fire sale situation. And, I'm not blaming Allsups because, as I say, they were the vehicle whereby these properties were run through. But it was a fire sale and you were associated with that.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you in relation to the theory whereby I think, when negotiations happen and deals can be done, that's the best scenario. And I think I would just challenge the fire sale perception, though, if I may, because the statistics are actually quite strong that it shows that actually the prices returned at auction are higher than you get elsewhere. It's probably unfair to tarnish a process with something that is, like, for instance, 180,000 people from around the world now actually read the catalogue every time it comes out. 140,000 of those are from Ireland, from within Ireland. So people are now putting properties into the auction with the highest private treaty price available going in as the reserve price, and they're getting about 24% extra. The reason being, I talk to buyers and I say, you realise you're paying a bit more potentially, and they say, we don't mind because the process is open. We can, you know what I mean? Often you hear reports about, is an estate agent telling you about offers that are true or not? You just don't know. There's a cloak. There's potential. You don't know where deals going on behind the closed doors. But
I'm not alleging any of that went on. Yeah. I'm simply saying that when property is bundled up. Some of it might have been commercial property and some of it was obviously residential property. And when they're being sold sort of as a bundle, it's then the lowest common denominator then comes into play.
I think, if you look at the property stories as a whole in today's paper, it's interesting to me, Micheál Martin spoke last night about the whole idea of two-tier austerity. Mm-hmm. I think this is particularly pronounced in terms of the property debate, because if you look at what's happening in the capital, and I know there's one article today that suggests that property prices are rising elsewhere, but it's really nothing like the kind of recovery that we're seeing in the capital. And in the capital, you're looking at one type of debate about carpet bagging and about, funny enough, what's going to be the scenario for people who have large amounts of debt but whose properties are moving back into positive equity, because the incentives for the banks there to do deals are doing less and the incentives to repossess are becoming greater. But there's really significant difference between that group of people and the scenario for those in residential properties down the country. And particularly if you look at the larger mid-east area, which there was huge expansion in the Celtic Tiger, places like Carlow, Portlaoise, Monaghan, Cavan, where you're right back down to the bottom, and the bottom is not budging. I'm out there every day doing research on this and I can tell you there's very little signs of recovery
out there.
You're
quite right, it's not budging. But the thing about
then we're back to the property tax, and they're saying that, you know, the revenue are now sort of forcing people to up their up the value of their properties, or saying, you know, your property is, but surely there's been a 10% rise. If you're talking about Dublin, there's been a 7 to 10, I'm sure, I'm open to correction, 7 to 10% rise in property values in Dublin. And so is next year, if there's another rise, will it have to go up again? You know, where is there some point where it stabilises?
I can't remember. My understanding when the valuations were being done for property tax, that whatever figure, well, presumably you weren't on the fiddle, presumably you were looking for the correct one, that would hold for 3 years, because it was at the very bottom at that point. And as you say, it still is outside of Dublin. But I would say for people who live in Dublin, that pretty well all of them will have got it slightly wrong now.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, Emma Kennedy writes about it there in the Business Post today, that 2,100 people so far have revised their valuations upwards. They're expecting another big surge before the deadline, which is the 31st of March.
But I thought that was to hold for 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, you're not adding what these people are doing. They may be getting confused, and who could blame them? You're not obliged to increase your valuation because the price has gone up. The question is, was the valuation you put on it last March ridiculously low?
Yeah.
And that's what the revenue chasing. But some people may think, oh, my house has gone up 10% since last March. I've got to up my property tax now. That's not the case. Now, next March, does it hold for 3 years?
My recollection now.
It does, but it still has to be right. So, I mean, because the difficulty is, if you're going to sell that property, sell the property and you haven't got your property tax in order, you have difficulties then.
No, so, but supposing you bought your house for 300,000 and it was, at the time of the property tax, worth 150,000, just call it 50%, right? So you say 150, in good faith, you put it in, it is the truth at the time, but it'll have snuck up by the time the 3 years are up. So if you sell your house after 3 years, are they going to penalise you?
I think it's probably, they're not probably the people we're talking about. I think they're the people who knew the value was 150 and they're putting it in at 100,000.
Right.
I think maybe.
But there was this whole confusion last year.
It makes no difference, Marion, right? I mean, you pay your property tax in 3 years. If prices have gone up 30% over these years, your property tax is up to 3%. It's only a cash flow thing. You don't have to do it next year, but you pay in the end, you know, because you pay the value.
But you pay it every year.
Yeah, but you're saying, and I'm not sure about this, you're saying that you don't have to increase it for 3 years.
Increase the value. That was my understanding.
Okay,
but
if that's true, come the 3 years, when you have to use the current value, then you'll effectively be paying all the back tax.
But there was this whole confusion, sorry, Ren, there was this whole confusion last year as to whether you were to pay it last year or whether you were to pay it this year. Because you remember the revenue came out and you had to declare. And you had to have your credit card details and all of that and given in. And so that was at that point last year, and say the house was worth 150K last year. And so now they're sort of frightening people and saying, you underestimated your property value. So maybe it was worth 175 last year. So who knows? And the thing is, now you're actually only paying it this year. So is it last year's value or is it now this year's value? And there could be only a 6 months in the difference between last year and this year. Do you know what I mean? And now there's the 10% gone up. And now people are saying, oh, now there's more confusion. Should I add on the 10% or the 7%? And maybe I did underestimate. But sure, nobody wanted to buy the house this time last year because there were no buyers out there.
And to add to that, to the level of confusion or difficulty in relation, it's actually very difficult to value property in a lot of parts of Ireland.
Sure, it's impossible because there are no buyers.
It's fine, but it's okay in Dublin or Galway, whereby you have lots and lots of evidence. But if you move into the less populated areas,
what are you going to benchmark it against? Yeah, because nothing else has been sold in the last 5 or 6 years.
Register and you find nothing has sold in your hometown for the last year and a half.
But I'd like to come back to
John
Moran's speech.
Yeah, because it was a very interesting
that's
speech.
That's property tax. Yeah. But this is about the property market. And I think, you know, one of the mistakes people are making is kind of saying, you know, is there a new bubble or whatever? In other words, kind of looking at the past repeating itself. I agree with Mr. Moran that the future property market will probably be something like we have never seen before in this country. It'll have lots of problems, but there'll be a different set of problems. Now,
way do you mean?
Well, essentially what he's saying, I must remember he's the Secretary General of the Department of Finance. He's essentially saying that people, ordinary people, will not be able to buy the traditional house, certainly in Dublin.
Three beds, not, front and back garden.
For two reasons. First of all, you know, they'll be outbid by those who are buying for investment, many of them foreigners, many local with cash. And secondly, and this was a line in his speech, that change on its own, that's moving to renting, alters the role of the banks because then fewer mortgages are needed. That's exactly what the Department of Finance wants, because the banks need to use their capital writing off debt, not providing fresh mortgages. Now, he says, it's understandable what he means by saying he's misquoted. Everybody leapt upon the three-bedroom house, which is the phrase the Taoiseach used. There's nothing like the phrase three-bedroom house to make the Irish public and media sit up and take notice. And the Daily Mail has a story today that Mr. Moran himself has substantial properties abroad, and that's fine. But it's irrelevant. And he was, and we have these extraordinary figures that the rents for an apartment is now actually higher than the average national rent for a house in Dublin for the first time. And what did the American funds do when they first came in? They bought apartment blocks. And just doing a very, very crude thing, right? The average rent in an apartment in Dublin is over €1,000 a month, right?
Yeah.
Now, this was actually from the Irish Independent last week, but I mean, I cut it out because the speech really struck me. You know, I mean, that gives you at a very rough, crude valuation of a decent yield for an investor. You could pay $250,000 for that apartment.
Huh? But surely, Brendan, that's for Dublin.
And the banks will not lend an ordinary average couple a mortgage of buying €250,000 apartment. So this is where the German model comes in, you know. Now, it may not work out quite as crudely as that, but the chance of what John Moran says, the idea that we'd all have a three-bedroom house in Dublin or its near suburbs may not come back.
Well, and he did also make the point about sprawl, and we have done that so many times, and it's absolutely awful stuff. But at 250,000, if you buy your apartment and you're getting 12,000 a year, you're not getting a great return on your investment, are you?
Well, one of the troubles with especially property is that people either expect to get 9-10% in bad times, or as during the boom, they would accept 1%, you know? Yeah. But I mean, I certainly think, you know, at current levels of interest rates, and I don't want to get into, I'm not a property analyst, but nevertheless, if you were getting 3-3.5%, that's currently relatively risk-free investment. You look at what US Treasury are paying you 0.5%.
Mm. Well, currently its yields are running for residential property in, say, Dublin City Centre, just to use as a barometer, at around 7% at the moment, gross. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you have to take into account that PRSI is now payable on rental income, as well as obviously income tax and various other property tax charges as well. So, you know, it may come down to maybe 6-5%. Right. I don't think it'll probably drop much more than that.
Right. But you wanted, just before, it's all linked in. It was both the speech last night, but the OECD report about the squeezed middle. Mm. And that and this all links into this, because housing and accommodation is a very important part of it.
Well, essentially, it's reinforcing a lot of what the OECD was saying this week about the kind of inequalities which have emerged out of austerity. We started austerity, having been through the Celtic Tiger, already as one of the European societies that was most unequal, and that process has been really exacerbated by what's happened during austerity. You know, I heard Micheál Martin reference it last night. It'll be interesting to see if Fianna Fáil in particular can get any traction with this particular line, but it is actually supported by the OECD, and it is also supported by a report that Oxfam did. And one of the things actually that the Oxfam report highlighted was the way in which there is a strata at the top of austerity societies throughout Europe, who is actually getting richer, while that group at the centre, and particularly you have many, you know, couples in kind of the 35 to 50 age group who are, you know, have huge debt, are losing their jobs, and they are the ones who are being particularly sharply affected by all of this, and they're being squeezed tighter and tighter, as well as obviously the most vulnerable who've had the welfare cuts. And you know, it goes back again to the Troika report, and if we look at the things that were achieved and the things that were done, and the groups which were supposed to be tackled in the Troika report, which still haven't been tackled, it makes for extremely interesting reading, and really supports what the OECD are saying, I think.
Right. I know that as we talk about all this, you're in your own battles on this, Jackie, but it is sub judice, isn't it?
Well, only certain parts of it are sub judice. I mean, I've been on the record saying exactly what happened in terms of pulling down viable businesses. And there's a particular piece here on page 7 of the Sunday Business Post, and the headline is finance officials in talks with RBS over Ulster Bank's future. And, you know, it's saying as to whether Ulster Bank is going to remain in Southern Ireland or not. It has cost RBS $6 billion to prop up Ulster Bank over the number of years. But I would suggest to the officials from the Department of Finance to engage in the dealings that Ulster Bank's past have, that they've done in the past, not what they're going to do in the future. Let's deal with the past before we deal with the future. You know, where virtually there's a huge investigation going on into RBS's behaviour with companies in the UK and in Northern Ireland, and But the Irish officials seem to think that it's fine to put their heads in the sand in relation to Southern Ireland. I mean, this was this came from the top. This just wasn't decided on by Ulster Bank in Southern Ireland. It was decided by RBS who put that whole thing in train.
Because the British taxpayers on the hook for that.
Correct, they are. And that's why there has to be, obviously, an investigation in the UK. But, I mean, the same tactics were in Southern Ireland, and yet the Irish government seemed to be quite happy to put their head in the sand in terms of that. Yes, we do need a third bank, and we need several banks in terms of competition in the country, and the citizens of Ireland need to have financial institutions that they can have trust in, and also that there is competition in the market. But it has to be a bank who has to be committed to Irish business and Irish people and Irish mortgages, and not just take back on demand anything that they want to do just overnight, 24 hours to pay back your loan, that type of thing. So
I would say, back to the famous Morgan Kelly. I mean, that was the point he was making, that if the banks really have to fix their loan books quickly, then an awful lot of SMEs are going to go down, because they're sitting on very often good businesses, but the owners built up bad property loans in the good times, and what's going to happen next. And, you know, I think I'd agree with Jackie that certainly, as with residential mortgages, as with this, the government is very reluctant, largely for political reasons, which I understand, to actually set out clear guidelines. But that leaves the problem, which is already arising, that people think so-and-so has been treated unfairly and so-and-so got a good deal. And you can't find out the whys and wherefores because it's all confidential. And I think the regulator ought to set out. I mean, you know, I actually believe in principle regulation, the stuff that got such a bad press, if it's done properly. You lay out the principles that should be dealt with in dealing with bad loans. You don't go into the regulator doesn't deal with individual cases, etc. We don't have any, and they don't want to bring any in.
Carl Dieter in the Business Post today addressed that quite interestingly, actually. He was saying that some of the issues that are coming down the tracks, actually rising prices have brought their own difficulties, because deals or negotiations that were in place before the financial ombudsman might be having some more cases coming to him, because as prices have risen, previous deals might be discussed as having capitalised a loss too early, crystallised a loss. But also in relation to the regulated side, I think the informal negotiations that are going on between borrowers and banks are actually, the banks want that because they have more control over the terms, whereas if it goes down the official regulated channel, then perhaps there's less control. So, but then again, and that does act as an incentive then.
But as in exactly in the case with the mortgages, where the low hanging fruit is the most likely to be pulled, it's the same in terms of the business sector. The easier the business is to pull, the more likely it is to be pulled. Whereas if you had massive loans and they couldn't pull your properties, that would be the case.
Because you made the point before that you wish you had owed more money.
Oh, absolutely.
And that you would have been in a better position.
Far better position, because then they couldn't get their money back.
There. I'm way over on the news. I'm going to the newsroom and John Finnerty.